Raven by Alan Hughes. Poems written and spoken by George Smith. This book is dedicated to the memory of John Sylvester, friend, father, family man, and flyer. It's read by me, Eric Madden. Introduction. The Adventures of Piran, an unusually inquisitive young raven who is a talented flyer, full of desire and a sense of wonder. He's driven to search for new experiences and new horizons, to explore his world to the full and to seek the truth. This is an allegorical tale aimed primarily at young readers, showing that true happiness comes from within, and that it is only through searching and seeking the truth that happiness and place come together to find meaning. Ravens are astute birds, intelligent, inquisitive, and communicative. They are the largest in the crow family, and so the strongest, but what makes them really different from the other crows is that they can reason. They can make informed decisions. They have a complicated language and can even learn the languages of other birds. At least Piran, our adventurous youngster, can. But he is not born yet.
Why doth yon horizon sport this knowing level stare? 'Tis naught but a beguiling band 'twixt land and sea and air. Oh, why do our mock vapour dreams inspire superfluous deeds, and crave to take us to those realms beyond our earthly needs? Shall it befit a raven to court with such a quest? We'll follow him with guardian eyes into the raging west.
The beginning. The story starts on the sandy shores of Llandwyn Island on Ynys Môn, where two young ravens, Cadfan and Morwenna, meet during the annual winter roost and decide to go together to find a territory in the mountains. They find a site in Ast Dhi, in the great Dinoric slate quarry. They build a nest, and the adventure begins. Cadfan is absorbed in a new trick. Mid-flight, he draws in one wing, flips onto his back, and instantly starts dropping like a shiny black stone. The elders can hold this position effortlessly, waiting until the last moment to pull out of the tumbling dive. Cadfan can flip, but is yet to drop for more than the blink of an eye. A steady wind blows in from the direction of the setting sun. It skims the pale green sea, drawing with it fine droplets of salty moisture before accelerating across the sand and shooting skywards in an invisible plume as it hits the bank of dunes flanking the beach. On late afternoons like this, conditions are ideal for perfecting aerial skills to show off to each other, and 50 or more young ravens are playing there on the turbulent updrafts. Cadfan doesn't notice the arrival of Morwenna, who approaches from inland, returning from the day's feeding site. She skirts the bleached sand in an arc to land on a small promontory of pillow lava that gives her an unbroken view of the beach, the forest, the distant mountains, and, of course, the aspiring acrobats. it is Cadvan who has been holding her gaze these past weeks. He has ability in abundance and an inherent confidence. None of his contemporaries are so advanced in their skills. None share his determination or willingness to practice. High above the dunes, the 3-year-old Cadvan begins yet another drop. To gauge progress, he counts. 1, 2, easy peasy. 3, 4, getting scary now. But he refuses to turn. On reaching 5, his best effort yet, the wind spins him slightly and he glimpses Morwenna. He falters momentarily, nearly losing control of the plummet, and must fight to regain his composure. 6, yes. Happy with his performance, Cadvan flips upright and pulls out of the dive so close to the ground that his wingtips brush the marram grass as he swoops away. Back in the updraft, he enjoys the free ride, then, with a faint wing dip, changes course and descends towards Morwenna, where he circles and signals for her to join him. She hesitates, nervous flutters rising in her chest, but he quells her uncertainty with that slight head tilt that has become his habitual way of telling her all is well. Unlike almost all the other juveniles, Cadvan is quietly spoken, saving his voice for moments of real need. Soon they are side by side, enjoying the playful wind in rehearsed unison under the last rays of a soft winter sun. The cacophonous croaks and calls of the night gathering are in full flow, but the pair are oblivious, absorbed in the simple delight of flight. A deep clonk interrupts their dance.
Morwenna, you're late. It's time to settle.
With one final glance at Cadvan, she drops her head in obedience and follows her brother, Jacka, toward the roost. Tonight, about 250 ravens have gathered to shelter in the canopy of tall pines, but in years past, so it's said, there would have been many hundreds more. As light fades, they compare notes from the day's foraging, barking their messages in excited bursts. Morwenna is only half listening. She's preoccupied. Cadvan has discovered an abandoned territory on the flanks of a distant mountain. He said that he wants her to journey there with him the very next morning as his mate. A 14-day moon casts quick silver shadows across the sleeping ravens, but Morwenna is wide awake, wrestling with her heart. Her folk are lowlanders, as were Cadvan's many generations ago, gentle coastal ravens, and they have warned her against the aggressive mountain dwellers like Cadvan. Morwenna believes he's different, but should she trust her instincts? First light illuminates a glittering hoar frost. The red-tipped needles on the lower branches of the Corsican pines sparkle like jewels, and Morwenna is struck by the duplicity of this disease that adds a flourish of beauty before the deadly fungus takes full hold. There is much talk these days of the forest's demise and the scarcity of food in the surrounds. Some say this is a bad omen, and many have already moved on in search of better pickings. Morwenna looks toward the snow-dusted mountains, her black eyes alive with excitement. Despite the hurt it will bring to loyal Jacka, she knows her time has come. As agreed, Cadvan is waiting at the southern tip of the beach. His neck feathers ruffle in pleasure as he watches her graceful approach, relieved that she has decided to join him. In silence they fly on, crossing the swirling river sea that separates beach from mainland, and at the ancient castle they strike inland toward the higher ground. Morwenna dare not look back, lest her brother is watching, his disapproving eyes clouded with sadness. They follow a beautiful tumbling river upstream until their reflections appear in the glassy surface of a ribbon lake. Resting briefly, they laugh at squabbling gulls diving for salmon eggs that lie thick and unguarded in the shallows of the first lake. Then, with long, heavy wing beats, the pair climb toward the snow line and enter a vast amphitheatre with walls of smooth grey-blue slate, fringed by towering slopes of dark, splintered rock. And this, Morwenna, is our new home.
Bird, bound in endless western weather, that but feather, egg, and feather. Feel the mountain's grip on time, draw thy fleeting breath, and fly thee deep betwixt the folds of life and death.
Morwenna is weary, and can imagine no comfort in a place so stark and angular. She croaks a weak protest, but Cadvan is already out of earshot in the furthest corner of the echoing hole. Come, Morwenna, come and see the nest! 2/3 up a sheer cliff, amidst a tangle of bramble and fern, is a ledge no wider than a wingspan, holding the bare bones of a decaying nest, half buried in snow. Cadvan croaks excitedly now, explaining how they will collect sheep's wool to make it soft and habitable. He looks at Morwenna expectantly, but she turns away, feeling shaky and unsure. In the far distance, she can make out the roost they left at dawn, the beach and a sliver of shiny sea. The view calms her, and at dusk she replies,
"It'll be just perfect, Cadvan. Let's make a start."
Ath thee, Dinorwig. In the mountains of Areri, the winter of 2010 was extremely cold. In late December, the temperature remained below freezing for 2 weeks, and the sun was just an orange shape in the sky with no heat emanating from it at all. This was when Cadvan and Morwenna arrived at Dinorwig. Ravens must start nesting early, in January, earlier than any other bird, in order to have food for their chicks when spring breaks in early April and lambing begins. The chicks will not fledge until May. Morwenna had never experienced such cold before. On their first night together on the nest ledge, Morwenna was very worried about their prospects in this inhospitable spot. But Cadvan was confident. He'd spent a few nights there before, during his scouting trips whilst looking for a new territory. He reassured Morwenna.
"This dry cold is good for us, Morwenna. It isn't so damp here as it is down by the sea, so it's easier to deal with the cold, believe me. We can snuggle up and ruffle our feathers to make an instant down jacket. Look, do this."
Cadvan ruffled his feathers, and in an instant his body bulked up with all the air that he had trapped inside them. Morwenna did the same, but looked sceptically at Cadvan.
"But there's a secret to it. Look, Morwenna."
Cadvan then put his beak into his feathers and blew warm breath into them.
"That will do the trick. It always works, especially on your belly feathers. That's where you lose the most heat to the ground. After a bit of practice, you'll have it down to a fine art, Mor," Cadvan enthused.
"We'll sleep in different places on different nights to test the ledge to see where's best to build the nest. I've found that the wind always whistles around here, and because of the shape of the quarry, circulating one way or the other. But no matter which way it blows around, it always blows up the cliff face,
so the ledge will give us shelter from the updrafts and a quick getaway should we need it. It's what makes this spot special, Cadvan continued excitedly. The windier it gets, the more sheltered it gets. It's also safe from fox and polecat proof and those little stoats, the really good climbers. I've seen them at it. You cannot get on this ledge except by flying to it. Cadvan rambled on. And polecats don't fly. Morwenna stayed quiet. I've seen that waterfall at the back blow upwards like smoke out of the chimney of a human house. But on the ledge here, there's been no wind at all. Whoever nested here before knew what they were doing. Morwenna finally interrupted. But we can't stand in the snow all night, Cadvan. Once more, Cadvan reassured his partner. Look, we'll perch on those rocks that stick out of the snow. The snow will be gone soon anyway, and then we can start building. It will be fine, Mor. Morwenna, still sceptical of Cadvan's confidence, shook and stirred as much air as she could into her feathers, and in a short while found that they were equal to this new challenge, and that pleased her greatly. She was warm, and she was falling asleep. Feathers are great. How can anyone live without feathers? Cadvan enthused. Any food around here? Morwenna replied. Don't worry. I'll tell you about Shirley's farm tomorrow. They slumbered.
Did those who first made love conceive thus much? Of mountains and of silken birds, fixed upon the all-given clutch, deep in moss and twigs infurled, each the other's brooding world.
Mountain life. Cadvan's main worry was not the weather, but would they be accepted by the Raven Mountain Elders? But he did not want to mention these concerns to Morwenna just yet. Usually, territories are handed down from parents to offspring, and it's quite unusual to have newcomers appear. There were 9 or 10 other territories in the valley, and all the other ravens would have to have their say about a new pair from outside the family lineage taking over old territory. This was ancient and proud raven country, since before the time of the great cold 10,000 years ago, and well before the first humans, the Ordoviches, appeared. They had given the mountain its name, a name still remembered in raven folklore. The city of the Ordoviches, or Dinorwic, as it's known by humans today. Cadvan liked the old ways, and although many ceremonies were no longer practiced by the Raven clans, Cadvan wanted to respect and acknowledge what was left of the great Raven traditions. The elders of this most spectacular mountain territory would not necessarily accept them. Newcomers would have to show respect and have some knowledge of past histories. They would have to be formally accepted by the other territory elders. These thoughts kept him awake late into the night. Morwenna awoke to the enthusiastic croaking of Cadvan as he wheeled very high above her in the crisp air above the quarry, a speck in the steely blue sky.
Quack, quack! Clonk, clonk! Come up, Morwenna. The air's great for playing today.
She hopped off the ledge and spread her wings.
Oh, the simple joy of flight, she beamed.
She felt the magic on every takeoff. Without any effort at all, she was wingtip to wingtip with Cadvan as they wheeled and tumbled together, surveying their newfound territory, Ast the Quarry, on the western edge of the great Dinoric Quarry, one of the largest slate quarries in the world. As the morning sun strengthened, the great blue-grey slate spoil heaps of Dinorwic absorbed the heat, and the air above them warmed quickly to generate powerful updrafts even now in the dead of winter. Cadvan had found a really good spot on a previous foray where the updraft was particularly strong, and he wanted to show it to Morwenna.
"Come on, Morwenna, follow me. I'll show you the strongest pump you've ever seen."
"Pump? Pump? What on earth's a pump?" she thought to herself. As they wheeled effortlessly higher and higher, Cadvan was way ahead, heading for the top of the great quarry hole. It looked like the biggest hewn-out hole in the whole mountain, 1,000 feet deep and 1,000 feet across. The old quarrymen called it Australia. It was open to the south and received the full heat of the sun. As the raven pair levelled with the top of the quarry workings, a place the quarrymen called Abyssinia, there was a tension in the air. Morwenna and Cadvan were being buffeted around a bit. They could feel a big thermal close by, sucking, thumping and pushing the air around them, a column of warmer, fast-rising air.
"This is it. All the updrafts joined together here," croaked Cadvan. "This is the pump."
It always works on sunny days. All the heat being generated from this great hole was concentrated into a strong rising column of air in one spot because of the shape of the mountain.
"Hang in there, Morwenna. Just watch me. You've got to get through the turbulence. You've got to be determined. Dig in. Hook into it with your inside wing. And once you're in, stay in."
Morwenna understood. She watched. Cadvan brought his outside wingtip up slightly, twitched his tail, and dived into the invisible turbulence with determination, ready to hook the rising column. His whole body was being buffeted violently. But suddenly he was released from the turbulence and shot upwards. He was in it. His voice faded away as he disappeared up and up at great speed, circling tightly to stay in the lift.
"Whee! Amazing!"
In no time he was just a tiny black dot against a single small white cloud in the brilliant blue sky. Morwenna flew away a little distance and collected her thoughts. "Help," she thought, "that looks terrifying." But she was up for it. She got close to the pump again, made a half-hearted attempt to enter it, failed, and flew away to give herself a good talking to. "What's the point of doing something half-heartedly? Now come on, you stupid bird. To live in this territory, I must master it. Now give it everything, like Cadvan did. You want to be here." Morwenna breathed deeply as she approached the pump for the third time. Cadvan was well out of sight now. She was alone. As she got closer, her feathers started ruffling with the air of the pump pushing her out, refusing her access. She got closer, and this time she was determined to get in. As she circled the invisible thing, she felt the shape and size of the great thermal and the way it pushed and pulled her, with every feather sensing the air around her. The noise in her ears became unbearable, but she timed her entry with perfection. And whoosh! Suddenly her ears went numb, as if they'd been covered by some invisible flap. She opened her eyes. It was now all very quiet, and she was shooting upwards at great speed. She had to wheel right over on her side to prevent herself from being thrown out, bending her neck right back to see upwards, reading the air with her wingtips.
"Heavens," she screamed, "this is so strong. My beak is so dry. I must stay in. I must stay in."
Morwenna held her tight turns until the thermal eventually started to dissipate, 3,000 feet high above the summit of Elidir Vaur, right under a small white cloud. She now understood that the small cloud was the top of the thermal. In other words, these clouds marked where the thermals were, and so where the lift was. She could now start to relax and look around as the pump loosened its grip on her. The whole thing had only taken a few minutes. She entered the cloud and lost her bearings for a moment. Cadvan was watching and waiting nearby, circling in clean air just a little below her.
Click, click. Great stuff, Morwenna. Come down a bit. Look at the sea. What?
Morwenna immediately looked to the west, towards home. She could make out the shape of the island of Llanduin immediately, and saw the coastline and forest of her home territory as she'd never seen it before. She'd never been so high and so far away from home, and now from this majestic vantage point it felt quite close somehow, perhaps just one long glide away. It was a safe feeling, which calmed her considerably.
"And over there!" shouted Cadvan, looking north. "And over there!" he shouted again, looking south.
Morwenna had never flown so high and had never seen her world like this. They were surrounded by the sea on three sides. To the west was the sea she already knew, but there were others she didn't know. By Ceredigion shimmered to the south, and even to the north there was a large expanse of darker water beyond the Carneddau Mountains that she had never been aware of before. There was land beyond that in the far distance. To the east she could see the green lowlands extending far away beyond the mountains of Areri. Now she could look down on every single summit. The highest was the whitest. Cadvan called it Gwyddfa Rita Gawr, named after the burial cairn of an ancient human giant and chief. From this height it seemed only a hop away across the valley. Morwenna felt good. She felt in control. She was especially content, a feeling she'd never experienced before. She reasoned it was maybe something to do with the release from danger she'd just experienced. Perhaps so, but at this moment nothing worried her. Without another word to each other, they gently floated down in close formation, taking their time doing huge, gentle circles, each tumbling in turn, each totally absorbed in the ease and pleasure of flight. Then, in a lightning flash of blue and black, whoosh! Cadvan felt talons stab his back with a force that knocked him off course. His head and tail bent violently upwards as his body was forced down. Whoosh! Another raven grabbed his talons, and all three birds fell in a frenzy out of the sky. A third bird had joined the fracas. But Morwenna dived in as if her life depended on it, and targeted the one with his talons in Cadvan's back. She grabbed his head with her talons and tore away. He lost his grip on Cadvan, and all five birds separated for a split second, before the three attackers realized the element of surprise was over, and flew off towards another huge hole right in the middle of the great quarry, Tush Maur. Cadvan and Morwenna had let their guard down, and had not noticed they were being watched all through their descent. The three ravens from Tush Maur had been gently thermaling over their own territory and had drifted above Cadvan and Morwenna as the pair descended. Cadvan had lost some feathers from his back. This did not affect his flying, but he was injured. They descended warily, landing on the skyline above their own nest ledge, and kept an eye out to the east. Cadvan rested, and Morwenna flew off away from the quarry towards farmland to look for food. There was often a dead sheep or some other carcass to feed off on the hillsides around the hill farms.
"Head for the green sheds," Cadvan croaked, as Morwenna flew off.
Before nesting could begin, Cadvan and Morwenna knew they had to receive the blessing of the mountain elders to do so. This could not be put off. they were summoned to a council on the summit of Moel Cynghorion, across the valley to the south of Athdi, one of a run of rounded summits west of Yrwyddfa. Also located nearby, they were told, were several ancient territories, the most revered of all that of Clogwyn Dir Ardi, the black cliff of the black place, where the wind was always strong and its ravens always the best flyers. Near here stood the mysterious Moel Cynghorion, and it was on this mountaintop that all disputes were sorted and all councils and introductions were held. This had been true from way back in time, apparently, for humans and ravens alike. But the humans did not know that the ravens knew this. Humans do not respect ravens. They do not give ravens credit for their role in nature, in clearing carcasses from the land, and for their intelligence and their high standing in the avian world. They have given them a bad reputation, especially since the farmer humans arrived just a few hundred years ago with their animals. As a result, ravens have suffered greatly at human hands. This is a great shame, Cadvan thought, since ravens could be eyes and ears for the humans if only they would cooperate. On the set and special day, Cadvan and Morwenna flew across the valley toward the midday sun, as they had been instructed. The mountains were still in the grip of winter, with a cold breeze from the north. They crossed over the twin ribbon lakes and gained height. They circled in the cold air as they approached the snowy flat-topped summit plateau of the mountain called Moel Cynghorion. The visibility improved. They landed on the side of Clogwyn Dir Ardi to look across and see what awaited them. Cadvan and Morwenna descended respectfully in a long, gentle glide into the middle of 20 ravens, who stood in a big circle in the snow. All the parent ravens from the 10 valley territories had turned out to greet them. Cadvan and Morwenna felt honoured and a little nervous. Beyond the circle, more ravens, last year's fledglings, looked untidy and hopped around quietly on the ground, watching. From the circle of the elders, each pair asked in turn, nothing too difficult, just polite questions.
Why this valley? Who is your father? Have you met the Tushmaur pair?
Cadvan and Morwenna relaxed as they realized this was a formality, an age-old procedure, and as long as they showed respect and answered politely, they would be accepted. And they were. And since the Tushmaur pair were mentioned, Morwenna related the story of their attack and was told in return to simply avoid and ignore them.
They're a bad lot, always causing trouble.
With the formal introduction over, they all rose together, all the ravens of the valley together for a moment, a rare sight, before going their separate ways. Cadvan and Morwenna continued along the ridge to the south for a while, just to see the Moel Eilio territory. It is reputed to have the best farm food in all the valley, at Joe's farm. Then they headed home, back across the Twin Lakes, back to Athdi, Dinorwic, their now official residence. Nesting. A raven's life is a dangerous one, with constant risks, most of all from humans. Even though the raven is one of the biggest and strongest birds in the air, territorial battles with some of the larger falcons, like buzzard or peregrine, can cause serious injury or even death. But ravens rarely die whilst in the air. The biggest risk to their lives is when they're on the ground, nesting. And that danger is from humans. Morwenna especially will have to be on the ground for a lot of the time over the next 4 months. The weather warmed over the next few days, and the first snow had melted a little. It was time to start building a nest. Morwenna found a reliable source of food, as Cadvan had promised, at the green sheds only 2 minutes away towards the village where the farmer woman kept horses and hens, as well as sheep, and all of them were given a feed of pellets every morning. There were always spilled pellets for the taking. These tasty morsels would be a godsend to Morwenna later on. For the next 2 weeks or so, a routine developed where the pair would collect sticks from one of the nearby woodlands and drop them on the old nest that emerged from the snow on the ledge. This old nest gave them a good base for their new nest. They'd had a choice of spots because there were two other old nests nearby. One was a bit too close to the waterfall for Morwenna's liking, and the other was too constricted, she felt, being in a bit of a hole under a pillar of slate. Morwenna was in charge. Cadvan was the muscle and sentinel, tirelessly flying to and fro, dropping sticks for Morwenna, who carefully arranged them with her beak. He would usually land to drop off the stick and fly off immediately. Cadvan was very cautious about being on the ground. Morwenna had simply accepted what she had to do and was on task. She had no choice. If she wanted young ones, she had to risk her life by being on the ground. She preferred ash twigs to make the base. They were strong and had knuckles on them which locked them together well. She would refuse some of Cadvan's deliveries if she felt they were not up to standard. She fussed a lot over making the base strong and well pleated. It was crucial to have a good, solid base. It would have to take over 4 months of wear and tear.
"This is too long, Cadvan. A bit shorter, please."
Cadvan tried to do what he was told.
"And why do you bring me these bits of orange string, Cadvan? That's no good. I want sticks, not string. What part of that do you not understand? Take it away. Go."
"Yes, Morwenna."
They would work hard for 2 hours or so, and then take some time off to play, fly around, and feed a little, then resume the building program. Sometimes Cadvan would just disappear completely, for up to an hour at a time. He would often go over the shoulder of Elidir to the north in search of food, and he would always return with something in his crop. This is sheep country, and tough country even for the hardy Welsh mountain sheep. If Cadvan was lucky enough to find a dead sheep, he would make caches of meat in special places along the hillside. He was always able to remember the places somehow. This was a useful tactic to make the most of the finds and keep the food for his family rather than leave the carcasses for the foxes to devour. At lambing time, there was much more chance of finding a sheep carcass when the sheep died giving birth, and in early April, his chicks would be at their hungriest. Cached meat was much more rewarding than having to scavenge for insects in the top field. Sometimes they would just take a break and land on the skyline slate tip, a good vantage point from where they could survey the whole of their quarry and get a good view to the east into the main quarry towards Tullamore. From their sentinel spot here, nothing could move anywhere near their nest without being spotted or heard. Ravens have good eyesight and great hearing.
"Curse the Tullamore mob," Cadvan mumbled. "My shoulder still hurts from that ambush."
"Funny that we've not seen them since the fight," mused Morwenna. "I'm sure I did some damage to that one when I grabbed his head."
"I hope so," said Cadvan.
"I think we need to get heather twigs now, Cadvan, to finish binding the pressure points around the rim. I think they would strengthen the inside of the nest as well before I line it. There's plenty of them about. Go."
Heather twigs are good for binding the rim of the nest.
They are springy and strong. They are also curly and so weave and hold together well. But how did Morwenna know this? Cadvan wondered. By now he was getting a little tired of being bossed around, and as he hopped around, he tried to look busy.
This is not a bad place at all, is it, Morwenna? We could have done a lot worse, you know.
Apart from the noisy humans who climb up on the rocks, replied Morwenna, and that roaring big bus that constantly turns up, that's getting on my wick.
The nest site was the nearest part of the quarry to humans. In fact, it was only a few hundred meters from the nest cliff to the end of the road where the noisy bus turned round. This had its drawbacks, because all the humans shouted a lot and sometimes climbed the rocks quite close to the nest itself. Very strange behavior, the ravens thought. But the great advantage was that it was very close to Shirley's farm and all that easy food. There and back in 5 minutes. Crucial timing when there will be eggs left exposed on the nest. The building progressed steadily, but with regular breaks for formation flyovers, when they would both fly along the faces of the slate tips, wingtip to wingtip. This was a clear signal to any other raven that this territory was occupied. Morwenna became more and more fussy as the heather twigs came in thick and fast. She would try the best-looking pieces here and there, shuffling the twigs sideways with her beak until they locked in. She would persevere with the longest and spindliest bits. These were the best when they fitted in, but sometimes when they didn't fit she would almost give up in exasperation, eventually breaking the twig with her beak to make it easier to fit. As these locking pieces went into place, she would rotate to and fro and snuggle down on the nest after each move around, rocking sideways, more rocking, then more turning to and fro to make sure the size was just right. Too loose a fit, and it would mean there would be cold spots. And if she were too tight in the nest, it would simply be uncomfortable. She'd have to have room for the lining, and then enough depth for the eggs, maybe 3 or 4 of them, she hoped. Her beak and tail feathers needed to fit just over the rim of the nest, no matter which way she sat in it, so she could see out and make a quick getaway if she had to. There was a lot to think about. After just over 2 weeks of weaving away, Morwenna announced, "Time to start lining."
"Wool, please, Cadvan. Lots of it. More brown than white."
"How do you know how to do all this, Morwenna?"
"My mother told me," she answered bluntly.
"Why brown wool?"
"You will see why when you fly over and look down."
Cadvan was impressed.
He hated this part of the job. The wool tickled his face and went in his eyes as he flew with it in his beak. But he put on a brave face as he watched Morwenna endlessly felting the wool he brought with her feet. As he flew in with big tufts of wool in his beak, he could see from above that the brown wool was much better camouflage for the nest than the white, and so less easily seen by any passing buzzard or mob of magpies. The best was speckled, he decided, as Morwenna already knew. Cadvan had learned something. This last part of the construction was the most tiring, but only Morwenna could do it, as the nest had to fit her and not Cadvan, who was a little bigger. The felting of the wool had to be done properly, so that it was of an even thickness and strong enough for 8 weeks of hard wear and tear. Morwenna would step on the wool with both feet, turn a little, and step down again, stirring the wool into a thick, strong felt. She would use her beak to tie in the bits high on the side and inside the rim of the nest. This lining took a week before Morwenna was satisfied. As the construction had progressed, so had their bond to each other. Every day they would stop work often to fly around the quarry, wing tip to wing tip.
each matching their every movement to the other. They had also been landing more often at their favourite spots, of which they had three. The watchtower slate block on the promontory opposite the nest, the sentinel spot on the skyline, and the wire fence in the top field. Every time they landed, Cadvan made a big fuss of Morwenna. He would preen her feathers for her, especially the feathers behind her neck, and stand very close to her, clicking and croaking sweet nothings in a soft voice. He ruffled his neck feathers as well to show his pleasure. During one of these get-togethers, whilst looking for insects in the top field, Cadvan leapt on Morwenna and they copulated. In an instant, the kerfuffle was over, and both Cadvan and Morwenna hopped up onto the wire fence nearby, looking ruffled but very pleased with themselves, because they knew now that eggs would be on the way. Everything was ready. Over the next week or so, as Cadvan recovered from his injuries, they explored their new surroundings and started making new friends. After their morning flights over the slate tips, every afternoon they would land to chat with the choughs when they came to the top field to feed, and Cadvan and Morwenna would feed with them. Raven and chough are distant relatives and speak different dialects of the same language. The ravens pitied the chough situation, having been told of the loss of their homeland completely to the humans. A coastal country far, far away to the south, a place they called Kernu. No one knows how or why this happened, but all chuffs are now scattered to the four winds, and their life is a wandering one. The chuffs loved this top field. It faced south and had plenty of sheep poo to attract the insects and nice wet ground to probe with their beautiful red beaks to find insects. Chuffs and ravens have a soft spot for each other, and they respect each other's flying abilities. Cadvan and Morwenna gleaned a lot of information in their conversations with the chuffs about their new territory and all the other nearby territories in the valley. They discovered that the previous family of the territory had mysteriously disappeared without trace during last year's hot summer, having been there for 20 years, half their lifetime. So they had been lucky to find the place when they did, because it was a very good territory and there was a lot of interest in it, especially from the Tull Maor mob. "We nest in a hole under the third level in Australia. It's just over from Tull Maor, and we hear the mob there arguing all the time. But we are safe in our nesting hole under the rails. Some of our coastal cousins come up here sometimes to visit and to play in the wind with us. There are not many of us left. But like you, we like it here." The chuffs agreed with Cadvan that the air above them over the slate tips of Dinorwig was great to play in, and this was of great importance in the lives of ravens and chuffs alike. Eggs. It was now the middle of February, the coldest part of the winter. More snow had fallen, and while Morwenna was spending more time on the nest during the day, shedding the snow off with her body, Cadvan was constantly alert to other dangers and suspicious of everything that moved in the quarry, especially the raucous humans down below. As they already knew, farmers would sometimes shoot ravens with their shotguns, and sometimes even aiming at the nest. It was going to be a very risky few weeks for Cadvan and Morwenna. The first egg appeared in early March, followed by another one in mid-March. Morwenna now spends most of her time brooding on the nest. She's on the ground, exposed to danger from humans and other predators. It would be easy for human climbers to reach the nest if they wanted to, but they seem happy clambering all over the rocks below. Strange behaviour. If nesting is successful, the fledglings will not fly the nest until early May,
2 months away. It's a long time to be exposed to danger, but Morwenna is resigned to it. She knows she has no choice and is fairly calm about the situation. Cadvan, by contrast, is in a flap. He flies over the nest, constantly clonking.
You okay, Morwenna?
Cadvan's main job is to cover for Morwenna when she takes 5 minutes off to feed down at Shirley's, and this is only 3 or 4 times a day. Even then, he doesn't sit on the eggs. It's too risky for him. He just keeps watch, constantly moving from ledge to ledge. This is when the eggs are totally exposed for 5 to 10 minutes, as Morwenna is feeding. When Morwenna is sitting on the eggs, Cadvan often lands nearby and struts about looking fearsome. At night, when Morwenna is on the nest, he either jumps up on the side of the nest or roosts a few feet away on the nest ledge. Cadvan is run ragged with worry. The first chick appears at the end of March, and the second a few days later. Cadvan is cock-a-hoop at first and wants to go and tell anybody and everybody. But he soon realizes that this is where the real hard work starts for him. He will have to feed the chicks. Chicks. The first chick, Piran, hatched on the 27th of March. The second, Elvis, hatched on the 7th of April, and they made rapid progress. Morwenna knows that someone is watching. When she hears the click of the camera shutter, and she always does, she looks over to the hide and eyeballs the large blinking glass eye. Morwenna is on task and has to accept the risks of being on the ground for long periods. Cadvan, by contrast, is much more suspicious and guards from a distance. Even at just over 2 weeks old, already the size of blackbirds, the chicks are very alert and have good hearing. If there is danger, the parents fly over and have a distinct call, meaning keep your head down and be quiet, and the chicks do so. The young ones slowly lose their warm down coat and start growing their waterproof flight feathers. As soon as they see a shadow or movement above, they automatically open their bright red gape, unless they are told not to. By the end of April, the weather is warm and Ath Dee becomes a sun trap. The chicks are getting too warm on some days, their eyes to the sky, always looking for the next feed. Good weather brings the noisy climbers out, but the shouting humans never get too close to the nest ledge. They prefer pulling on the much smaller ledges. Strange behavior. April sees full-time feeding by both parents. There is a lot of wear and tear on the fabric of the nest. Cadvan's stashes of meat come in handy, and he carries the food back to the chicks in his crop. By the end of April, the chicks' flight feathers are looking smart, and the siblings now fill the nest. Piran and Elvis become bolder, but are still confined and stay within touching distance of the nest. The chicks are at their hungriest and most demanding at the end of April. Piran is the first to leave the disintegrating nest and explore further along the ledge. The early May sunshine is a bonus for the chicks. They are left alone for longer periods while Cadvan and Morwenna find food for them. Piran now starts to flex his wings in earnest. He's a week older than his brother. The young ones can be tough, if well fed, and the wool lining of the nest stays warm even in the wet. By mid-May, the chicks are thinking about leaving the ledge and have been flexing their wings for hours every day. They are now the same size as their parents, and always ravenous. The fully grown chicks are now left alone for longer periods, and Cadvan stops feeding them on the nest ledge and calls to the chicks to leave the ledge. Wing exercise becomes an obsessive activity, especially for Piran. Now, both parents stop visiting the nest ledge. On the 14th of May, Piran flies off the nest ledge into a nearby ash tree, a flight of 20 meters. A few days later, Elvis leaves the nest ledge, but does not go far and lingers on another ledge for a further 2 days. Finally, both chicks explore further ledges and tree branches, still being fed by the parents. Soon, both Piran and Elvis are fully fledged and start exploring Ahti and the surroundings. The noisy climbers below them are absorbed in their own world and can only see as far as the next move. They have been oblivious to the unfolding drama above them. Piran and Elvis now explore their brave new world, Hwarel Dinorwig, one of the largest slate quarries in the world. In the air, they are safe. They have survived the most dangerous part of their lives, the first 3 months. High summer. It's now August. High summer. Young Piran and Elvis have had 2 months to explore their immediate surroundings at Dinorwig. They can now find food and feed for themselves. Piran is immediately adventurous in his behavior, staying out for days sometimes, often venturing off alone around the whole of Hwarel Dinorwig in all weather conditions. Whereas Elvis has stayed close to Ahti and close to his parents, Cadvan, Morwenna and Elvis often fly in a three formation and stay very local, just doing what ravens do. September arrives and there is excitement in the air. All the young ravens from all the mountain territories far and wide get together to meet and greet. The Carneddau to the north is a good place to do this. It is the largest area of high mountain in the whole country, and it is a relatively safe area, being far away from dangerous humans. Large groups of young ravens are here to impress each other. No one knows exactly why, but this has always happened in this location. Piran flies over the Ogwen Valley with Elvis, his brother, the first time they have left Dinorwig together. They cross the Ogwen Valley to the wide, rough expanses of high mountain and moorland of the Carneddau, just to the north of their home territory. Youngsters from very many territories around are doing the same thing. Elvis is expectant and excited, but Piran is not so happy mixing with all these croaking youngsters. He wants to know more about raven history and raven mythology, and all these young ravens know nothing of this. Elvis is remarkably at ease away from his parents for the first time, and is quite a chatterbox. He loves a good natter. Piran puts up with the situation, stays close to his brother, and is polite to the other youngsters. He finds some new places to explore. While Elvis enjoys the social aspect of the gathering, Piran is more interested in learning from his elders than his peers. Ravens have a strong social order. There are spoken and unspoken rules. Piran is a good listener, but he never totally accepts any information at face value. Unlike his brother, he questions everything. He is fascinated by the past and by the knowledge that has been gained by his ancestors. Raven folklore is rich and valuable, but details have often disappeared in the mist of time. Piran is a strong flyer
and from his very first flight he has constantly practiced flying manoeuvres in dangerous wind conditions. He is seen out in all weathers, and is often berated by the elders for taking unnecessary risks. He quickly becomes a skillful flyer, a master of the air, and is respected for his abilities by his peers. After his autumn adventures over the Carnedhai, Piran returns to his parents at the quarry, not overly keen to go in any particular direction with his life. Cadvan and Morwenna are pleased to have him around for a while, as Elvis, his brother, has stayed in Dinorwic. The family spends an enjoyable few weeks, often flying in a formation of four around the quarry, just enjoying being there. Boy, can those gulls soar! Every morning, whilst flying and playing and tumbling around the quarry with his parents and Elvis, Piran sees the gulls going past, soaring so easily on the wind. And every day he says to himself, boy, can those gulls soar. Their flying is so efficient.
Don't take any notice of them, Piran, his father had said. An unfaithful lot, those gulls. They've forgotten how to feed by the sea, as they're supposed to, and they change their partners every year. Now they invade our territory every day of the year. No respect.
But Piran has noticed the gull's flying abilities, and thinks quietly that he has much to learn from them on the subject of flying. Areri is high mountain land, surrounded on three sides by the sea. The highest peak, Yrwyddfa, is only 5 miles as the crow flies from Dinorwig. It is the highest mountain in the whole country, and because of this, it has the strongest winds of all. It also has the most humans clambering over it, and all are brightly coloured, like the climbers in the quarry. Very strange. There are hundreds of humans on some days, as Piran has noticed on previous visits. And he's also noticed that every time the humans sit down, when they start off again, they leave food behind, especially around the summit. This is what the gulls scavenge on. They come every day just for these scraps of food. Late autumn drifts into winter in Snowdonia, and Piran decides to run with a gang of gulls on Yrwyddfa to learn more about mountain flying. He decides to fly there from the quarry every day. He wants to become super fit and to learn how to avoid rotors and dangerous downdrafts and how to land and take off in strong conditions. What better practice than to scavenge like the gulls? He notices the humans often shelter to eat in the lee of the wind and near the summit where the winds are very strong. There was a place just below the summit near the train station where humans often stop and sit. The wind whistles over the ridge here, a great place to practice dangerous landings and takeoffs. Piran tries and finds it very difficult. To reach the scraps, he has to fly from very fast winds to a perfect lull in a split second. The gulls are experts at handling these rotors, while Piran improves slowly with practice. He finds it risky and could easily be injured. After this experience, he is even more in admiration of the gulls' abilities in flight. However, gulls are looked down upon by the ravens. They have no language, no self-esteem, no manners, and they fight over every scrap of food. They utter a sort of loud cackling, which couldn't be called a language at all, just a very annoying noise, and so high-pitched. It's impossible to communicate with them properly. But what makes them such good flyers, Piran wonders, and how can I find out and learn from them?
As the gulls pass Dinorwic effortlessly every day, flying from sea to summit to scavenge, Piran flies with them, studying their movements closely and watching exactly how they use their wings. He notices that their wings are narrower and longer than his in relation to their body size, which is the same. So Piran reasons that he needs to make his wings longer and narrower. He experiments above the quarries and attempts to follow any gull that passes, trying to stay close. The gulls merely cackle and ignore him and always leave him behind in their wake. Piran begins to realize just how good these birds are at using the wind. And one day, as he settles exhausted on a high ledge in Bultlamberis, after one particularly fraught attempt at following a group of gulls on their way to Yrwydvar, he thinks to himself, how on earth do they know where to find the thermals? Can they see them from afar, he wonders? Can they actually see rising warm air from a distance? With no answers to these questions and no help to be had from the other ravens to find the answers, Piran becomes even more determined. If I could fly like that, I could go far. Just imagine. Every day, Piran leaves the safe confines of his parents' territory in Dinorwig and flies over the raven territories of Bultlanberis and Clogwyndir Ardi to get to the summit of Yrwydvar. He starts to practice and thermals up to get some height to begin with. This time of year is not so good for thermals, but there are some good days. He starts gliding, and he pushes his wings forward, stretching out his primary feathers as much as he can, and at the same time tucking in the trailing edges of his wings to make them narrower. He also has to change the shape of his wings from front to back, the pitch. He practices endlessly for hours at a time. Pretending to be a gull is hard work. After each glide, he has to find a thermal to gain height again, to get to the cloud base so he can glide again. As he practices, he looks a bit foolish to his peers, and is laughed at and even frowned on by the other ravens, young and old alike. Gulls are considered mindless hooligans by most ravens, because they invade raven territory without so much as a by your leave. Piran is always advised to stay clear of them.
What on earth are you doing mixing with those gulls?
They are so noisy, inconsiderate, and hostile to each other. The elders croak at him, but as he soars in the updraft above the summit of Yrwydvar, a single black dot amongst the many gulls, Piran knows he is learning something very useful. He finds that he can catch and soar the thermals just a little bit better, and so he can gain height quicker and with less effort in order to glide a little further. A useful skill, Piran thinks to himself, and changing the pitch of his wings definitely makes him go faster without much extra effort. I'll now be able to glide further. I'll show them. By early spring, Piran can make the glide from Yrwydvar to his home quarry very quickly and in one glide, without a single flap of his wings, something none of the other youngsters can do, or even the elders as far as Piran can see.
What good is that? Say some of his friends, not impressed at all. Why bother? What's the benefit?
But young Piran can already feel it in his bones that by making very small gains in his flying abilities, he can go further with less effort, and he's already making plans to travel. Elvis is quite happy to stay in Dinorwic, close to his parents, but Piran wants to travel. He wants to see and learn more about the wider world, other places, and he knows that he needs these extra skills to make his plans possible. One day, whilst flying alone practicing landings, Piran notices a young gull sitting in the snow on top of Clogwyndir Ardi, and he approaches inquisitively on foot
Do you like it up here?
Pirin asks in his best cackle.
I do like a bit of fresh snow crunching under my feet, responded the young gull. I'm Whitney, and I like snow, said Whitney, introducing himself.
Well, this was certainly a different gull, thought Pirin.
Tell me, Whitney, said Pirin, straight to the point and making most of this opportunity. How do you know where the thermals are when you're flying? Can you see them? No, we can't see them. It's all done by feel, said Whitney. Our primary feathers are very sensitive to the air around them, so we can feel further and create a map of the best place to get the most out of the wind.
Pirin said nothing. He just listened, fascinated.
Whitney continued. But it's a whole body thing. You listen with every feather on your body. You can then, with practice, sense what the air pressure is doing all around you. Feel it side to side, nose to tail, wing tip to wing tip.
He then added, But I'm fed up with flying. I prefer mountaineering to flying, especially when the ground conditions are this good.
What superb conditions! I love snow.
Pirin thanked Whitney and went on his way, chuckling to himself.
It's a whole body thing, eh?
Llanddwyn.
Make peace with the headwind. Harness her lift for free. As the sea rolls in, and the land rolls into the sea.
After a winter of flying in the mountains, like the gulls, often competing for scraps of food left behind by the humans, Pirin rejects the scavenging way of life. He's ready for something new. One evening on Yrwydfa, he decides not to return to Dinorwig, but to follow the gulls as they fly back to their roosts far away on the coast. This will be his longest flight so far, some 30 miles, and something the gulls did every day there and back, with such little effort. As soon as the first gull starts to glide away to the west, he follows, knowing that the timing of the beginning of his flight has to be right. Too early and he would be fighting the sea breeze. If too late, there would be no lift left to glide on, and he would be dumped in darkness in some unknown place. He needs a good start. The gulls head for the coast. He follows. Without saying anything to his parents, he just goes. One by one, the gulls slowly pass him on the glide, cackling away, all heading for the dark forest just across from the sea river, Avon Menai. Pirin's mother, Morwenna, has told him about this river which flows in two directions, and about the forest and the open sea beyond. Pirin had always wondered what the distant, flat-looking, shiny expanse of water was really like. From Athdi it often glowed a beautiful orange colour in the evening sun far away in the distance. But he had been told he was a mountain raven, and he should stay in the mountains to take his turn to find territory and settle down. Although occasionally young ravens would fly away and never be seen by their families again, most followed the rules and stayed close to home until it was time for them to settle. Elvis was a home bird, but Pirin's eyes were always on the horizon, his mind always beyond.
How wast when it began, thou motley egg? Didst thy folks a fledgling make, or merely hatch a plan? In every generation there is a straying bird that spreads the stamp of raven beyond the regioned herd.
Pirin makes it to the coast in one glide down Dufferin Seant to the ancient castle, and with height to spare. He is pleased with his performance, so he ventures over the narrow Avon Menai. With his energy levels high, he keeps up with the last of the gulls and makes it to the sand at the edge of the great black forest. Then he keeps going and flies the short distance from the sea river to the open sea.
"What a place," he says. "I've never seen this much expanse of water before."
He turns right. It's getting dark. The gulls have landed in large groups on the beach to roost, but Piran decides to roost in the pine forest behind and chooses a tall Monterey pine to roost in. He wasn't happy being so close to the noisy water. Ravens are careful when flying over water. They cannot swim. This is a place he knows from his mother's stories. This is Llanduin, and in Raven folklore, it is where the great gathering will happen later that winter, as it has done for thousands of years. There are not many ravens here in early summer, and Piran feels quite alone in this noisy, dark and whistly windy place. Next morning he ventures carefully out over the sea just to see what it's like. He flies along the coast to have a good look around. He likes the smell of the sea and is surprised to see that its surface is roughed up by the wind, unlike the land. But he never thought it would be so noisy. He finds that there are no updrafts nor any thermals at all. No lift at all. Only a clean and steady wind. "That's very disappointing," he thinks. As Piran flies along the sandy inlets and small sea cliffs, he's surprised at the variety of birds he sees. All of them are weird and wonderful to his fresh eyes. He wonders how the many varied and strange smaller seabirds he sees can fly so fast and so low over the waves. He is envious that they can land on the water anywhere they fancy. Some of them even fly underwater. Unbelievable! Some make very strange calls to each other. Some, he notices, have short, stocky wings, and others have long, elegant wings. Most are black and white. Some are grey, some brown, some speckled, all different sizes. Some have red bills, and others yellow. There are many different sorts of bills. Some have tube noses on their bills. Some have very pointy bills, and others are curved. Some of the seabirds have big, colourful, beaky bills. Unlike all these weird and wonderful seabirds, Piran has to work hard as he ventures out over the water, maintaining his height. He knows instinctively that to land in water is a certain death for a raven. Piran, now far out over the open sea, has to handle the fear of this new situation and make sense of it all. Without panic. Deep breathing. Clear head. Fear can be a friend, he reasons calmly to himself, if only I can think clearly. I can stay out here for as long as I have strength in my wings to return to shore. He flies in a big, long arc about 50 feet above the waves and eventually back towards Maastricht Beach. On the return to the beach over solid sand, he feels the most intense satisfaction. What an adventure, he thinks to himself. I want more of this.
The wind carved the waves, and the waves carved the shore. And nobody knows the first carver no more. It must have been strong, and it must have been grand to chisel the waves that chisel the land. Or is it our wingbeat as whips round the world from a feathery flap? Is a breaker unfurled?
Kitto and Quick. Later in the day, Back on the edge of the forest whilst resting and recovering from his first tentative foray out over the open sea, Piran hears a distinct call he remembers from Dinorwig. Chuffs. And he finds two young chuffs chattering and foraging for insects in the seaweed on the shore. When Piran was young and still in the nest, he would hear the chuffs' distinctive calls coming from the fields above the nesting ledge as they fed. As soon as he fledged, he had befriended the pair, who were born in a deep cleft in the great quarry, friends of his parents. They had helped him and had showed him the best places to find insects when his parents had left him to fend for himself in the first few weeks of flying alone. So he had a very special regard for these birds. He remembers from stories that his parents told him how these rare and beautiful birds with bright red beaks and red legs were distant relatives of the raven, and how, sadly, the chuffs had lost touch with their original homeland of Cernyw, a place far, far in the south. The chuffs were now permanent travellers in other birds' territories, having to nest deep in dark, dank caves as a punishment for losing their historical home territory. This was seen as very sad by the ravens. And, like the ravens, the chuffs were excellent mountain flyers and were considered trusted friends. There was nothing they enjoyed more than playing in the wind. The days flew by, with Piran wondering what his next move would be. Conform to traditional life like his brother and return to Dinorwig? Or keep on travelling? Every afternoon he would play on the updrafts on the front face of the sand dunes. When the wind direction was perfect and at a right angle to the dune line, he could soar 100 feet straight up, then tumble down doing tricks. He quite enjoyed showing off to some of the older ravens that were there. Every night he sought out the chuffs on the seaweed for company and a bedtime snack of insects, and he often roosted with them. Eventually, he got a grasp of their language, but they talked so fast. The chuffs were called Kitto and Quick, and they were very chatty.
These fooling chuffs do roll and twist in the thrusting air as if to a moulded of a tempest sea. Follow their poetry into the parchment sky, where they are joy's furious scriveners.
The days flew by. Piran was quite enjoying his life by the sea. It was such a contrast to his previous winter spent in the mountains scavenging with the other ravens. He would get information every night about where the best food was to be found in the fields away from the coast. He would go feeding at these places first thing, then fly back to the safety of the coast every afternoon and play in the wind for hours at a time. He was itching to travel, but where to? Where could he go? Chuff language is similar to the ravens, and in the evenings Piran would listen to Kitto and Quick talking about an island far to the south along the coast, almost beyond the horizon. They had learned the songlines of the coast to the south from their cousins, and Piran had made an effort to learn the words himself from the chuffs. Enthly, he was told, was the last dot he could see in a line of blue-grey dots sticking out from the sea to the south. They were the tops of distant mountains, and the very last one was the island called Enthly. The chuffs talked of it as a special place, revered in chuff and raven folklore alike, and a hard place to get to, especially for a mountain bird. "It's on the way to Cernyw," they often said in mid-conversation. Piran was fascinated by this island in the distance, and even more by the mysterious Cernyw they kept mentioning. He looked to the west longingly, and he decided one night that he too would soon go west. It was the beginning of summer, and Pirin was becoming restless. There were a few other ravens around. In the summer, ravens are scattered around the countryside. But there was one young female called Erona, who had caught Pirin's gaze while flying in the dunes. Erona was a particularly fine flyer, Pirin thought. It was time to do something. Going home was not on his mind at all. The seabirds were all busy sitting on their eggs. Pretty soon, all along the coast, the eggs would hatch and the chicks would need feeding. The screaming of the gulls would become unbearable. The mystical homeland of the choughs, the place called Cernu, sounded a lot more attractive as a place to be. As a young raven, Pirin has an allowance by the older ravens who hold territory to pass through that territory, as long as he can recite the songline for that place. The same applies to all members of the crow family. To know the words of a songline shows respect for the place and for those who live there. But this can only happen if the young raven can recite the correct songline in full for that place. In this way, the young ravens gain respect for others' territory and also learn where to find food as they travel. This is of high value for a raven and is quite a proud and special feature in the avian world. For 3 years, young ravens are allowed to travel like this, should they want to. Afterwards, they're expected to find a partner and stay with that partner close to their territory of birth for their lifetime, which could be for 30 years. Sometimes ravens live for 40 years, and they will always stay faithful to their partner. By now, Kitto and Quick were the best of friends with Pirin, and they met every night on the beach, feeding on the insects in the seaweed that the tide washed up. When Pirin mentioned his travel plan to go west, they explained how they had tried that same journey a few days earlier, but their attempt to pass the very first obstacle had been refused by the Carreg Allam elders. The elders had been in a bad mood after a battle with a pair of peregrines and a buzzard. Ravens are always in dispute with peregrines and buzzards. Once one songline is remembered and used to pass through a territory, in order to continue travelling, the next songline had to be learnt, and so on. But there are some key territories that guard the other territories, and those songlines absolutely must be learnt properly by all members of the crow family who travel. Kitto and Quick had not learnt the lines quite well enough. Once past the Carreg Allam territory, the whole of the scene opens up to any young traveller. To Carreg Allam.
It is time to do something. Pirin is talking to himself again. He feels the urge to start on his adventure to visit Ensli. One day, instead of going to forage inland as usual, Pirin quietly sets off to the south from Llandwyn along the low-lying coastland, without telling anyone. He soon comes across three impressive mountains that block his way as they fall steeply to the sea. These are Arevel. Pirin asks a young raven he meets where the elders live, and is told that they nest on the cliff of the many-coloured goats a little further along the coast. This is the impressive cliff of Carreg Allam on Penrhyn Glas. Pirin approaches cautiously, lands at a respectful distance, introduces himself to the elders, and explains his mission. Pirin recites the songline, and this pleases the Carreg Allam pair greatly.
"Not many ravens know our songline in full anymore," they say. "You show respect. Sometimes even our own young ones do not know the words. There is little respect these days."
They have had a good day fighting off peregrine falcons from the nesting ledges and are in a good mood. He is allowed to pass. This is a boost to Piran's confidence. It opens the way west. Later, while wheeling over Penryn Glass in celebration flight, Piran catches sight of his two friends, Kitto and Quick, paying in the winds.
"Did you get through?" Piran clonked.
"See you on Entley," they chattered back,
heading down toward the long pebble beach beyond Penryn Glass.
Is there a spirit bird, as makes for the even sun? Oh, 'tis a wanton thing that chases night's veil. What, wouldst thou follow the fixed stars and find heaven? Roost, roost a while, young'un. Let thy earthen sense prevail.
On the Sleen Peninsula, the best coastal territories are next to the seabird nesting colonies and are very closely guarded by some of the biggest and strongest ravens Piran has ever seen. He is challenged often. He sometimes forgets some of the lines of the songline for this coast, which makes him feel a little frightened. He makes a diversion inland to find all the young ravens that are without territory congregating on a monad knock, Garn Vadrin, with its grand views over the green plains of the Sleen Peninsula. Here he is quizzed by the other youngsters, playing in the wind, all of them coast ravens.
"Where are you from? Where are you going? Why?"
The farmland hereabouts has better foraging than in the mountains, as the ground is soft and insects are plentiful. But there are no dead animals to be seen anywhere. The land is completely given over to humans and their farms. Piran spends less time looking for food and more time thinking and daydreaming on his favourite perch, a lovely warm granite block on the west side of Garn Vadrin. He answers the others as best he can, but is quietly dismissive of their chatter. He prefers daydreaming alone at the moment. He knows there is a big challenge in front of him.
The dust in thy gizzard, the bones on the shore, are fragments of those who have travelled before, who failed on their watch, of the foe in the skies. One creature's feed is another's demise.
It's warmer down here than in the mountains. Piran loves flying to the west toward the setting sun. It makes his mind wander. What is beyond the sea? He loves discovering new places and flying around new headlands, but he can see that this land is fast running out. There is sea on both sides now. The peninsula is getting narrower and narrower. At the furthest and narrowest point of the peninsula, a place called Sunt Enlli, Piran comes across a most unusual raven's nest. A nest without a ledge. A most incredibly constructed nest built beautifully on roughness on a vertical cliff face, with no ledge at all holding it up. That's a work of art and not a nest, Piran mused as he appreciated this carefully arranged pile of twigs.
I'm sure I can learn a thing or two from whoever built that one, he said to himself. When the time comes. Oh, I do like a bit of confidence in a bird, he admitted.
Piran thinks to himself how he enjoys learning from other ravens he meets on his travels, whenever he can, and he learns the song lines for the next section of coastline from the Garn Vadrin youths as he goes along. He feels good about his adventure to the west, and feels that he can travel safely as long as he is prepared for each step. From his perch on Garn Vadrin, he can see far to the west. And finally, on a clear day, he can see the last land, Entley.
he learns the songline to its end, to the end of the land. He feels a little scared. To Ensley.
To the knuckle of Uchminnith, feel for the rough-cut lift of the west wind, and reach, bird, for thy ancestors' ghostly glide. Let not the fathoms below sink thy slick black spirit, but to Innis-Entley go.
After a few days spent playing on the updrafts of Garn Vadrin, Pirin decides to attempt the open crossing to Innis-Entley. He feels ready for a new adventure. He's dissatisfied with looking for insects in the same fields day after day with the other noisy young ravens. To cross the sound from the mainland to Entley, there is a 2-mile open crossing over a very rough sea where the tides are squeezed between the mainland and the island. The island itself looks like a stone in a fast-flowing river, but on an enormous scale, with white water everywhere. This is not a great distance for Pirin. He has flown the same distance over the sea before, but flying over such a huge tide race feels intimidating. He soars as high as possible over Uchminnith, the last mountain on the peninsula, until the last and highest thermal dies out. Then, trimming his wings like a gull as he has learned to, he goes for the glide. The wind is from the west and gently against him, and by the time he reaches the island, he is quite low over the rough white water, but he has enough energy to beat hard with his wings. As he is flying along the cliffs of Entley, he is thrilled with the situation he's put himself in. He feels so good. He sees masses of seabirds on the cliffs. He can even hear them above the noise of the sea, which is a cauldron of currents and countercurrents, the like of which he has never seen before. It's early July, and there are lots of chicks on the nest ledges, because the seabirds are late nesters compared to the ravens. Pirin also sees many birds flying close to the water, some of which he's never seen before. He notices some particularly elegant birds, quite magnificent flyers, he thinks, even at a first and fleeting glance. They have dark blue-black backs and a white underneath. In fact, he decides immediately, these birds are the best flyers he's ever seen, even better than the gulls. Pirin lands on Entley, the island in the tide race. He has made it. But his attentions are all taken up by those fast flyers. From a cliff above the sea, he looks around him at this exciting new place. There are so many birds around. But the fast ones are only over the sea. Not one is over the land. As he watches these elegant ones, he thinks to himself, "Wow, what a beauty! They go so fast, so effortlessly. They hardly ever seem to beat their wings at all, and they fly so close to the waves that their wingtips seem to shear the water. How do they do that?" Pirin mutters to himself. He's so impressed, he takes off again to try and fly to the fast ones. But he can't even get close to them because they fly so fast, much faster than he can. Pirin gives up the chase. He realizes he's very tired, so he chooses a cliff-top ledge to roost on. At dusk, the fast ones land together on the water in huge rafts, maybe a few hundred altogether. Pirin wonders why they do not land on the cliffs as he and most of the other seabirds have done. Next morning, he flies around the island looking for Kitto and Quick to ask them about the fast birds. His friends are difficult to find because there are so many choughs on Entley. He's counted almost 40 already. Ravens are good at counting. Kitto and Quick should be amongst them somewhere.
Eventually he finds them chattering as usual and feeding on insects that they find in huge mounds of foul-smelling seaweed on the only beach on the north side of Entley. They tell him that the fast-flying birds are called Manxies, and that Entley is a Manxy stronghold, as well as being the capital of a resurgent population of choughs.
"Some say there are 20,000 Manxies nesting here," Kitto says. "Silly humans thinks they're the ghosts of dead saints because of their eerie clicking calls, but they're not," Quick adds quickly.
"They are little birds and they nest in old rabbit burrows and only come into land when it's dark, pitch black in fact, when there's no moon at all. They would be killed by the black-backed gulls if they landed in daylight, or even on a moonlit night." The blackbacks are big, the biggest of all the gulls. They take no prisoners, and are a challenge even to the ravens themselves. Kitto continues. "On the ground, the Manxies are easy to catch and kill, because they're super adapted just to fly and swim. It's why they're so fast. Their legs are too far back on their bodies and they trip over when they have to run from the landing to their burrows. They have to do this as often as they dare to relieve their partners on the nest. They are safe in rafts on the water waiting for a dark night to come inland because they can take off from the water very quickly and fly faster than the blackbacks. The Manxies have the strangest language of all, a sort of rapid clicking that seems to make no sense at all. It's so they can recognize their partners in the dark, in the burrows."
Here, discern the Manxy tongue, for in their guarded passing they shall inform a traveller of their mettle for the next passage. Which is but smooth or untoward, the time most meet, the wind, the tide, the state of sea. So as who travels may traveller be.
Piran decides he must meet a Manxy to try and learn the secret of this fast, low-flying. He flies to the place the choughs have indicated and he waits. He's on a big boulder in a field on a hillside facing west. When eventually it gets properly dark, the clicking starts. Soon the air is filled with clicks. The one Manxy parent is inside the nest hole sitting on eggs and clicking. The other has been feeding out at sea and is coming in to relieve his partner, trying to find the nest hole also by clicking. But there are hundreds of nests, thousands of Manxies. This is, after all, one of the largest Manxy nest sites in the world.
How did they do it?
A mad melee ensues, with hundreds of Manxies colliding with the ground and with each other, and also with Piran. It becomes a rough and tumble, and it's impossible to stand up straight, let alone start a sort of conversation in a strange language, in the dark. He gives up, and has a very difficult time himself, flying back to his roost on the cliff, aided only by the intermittent flashing light of the island's lighthouse. In the morning, Piran returns to the hillside where the nests are. The Manxies have a hard time on land, and he sees several dead birds around the nesting area where they were killed by the blackbacks in the panic of the night. He stands at the entrance of a rabbit hole, cocks his head and clicks, trying to imitate a Manxy. At first, he doesn't get any replies, and he shimmies from hole to hole, making the clicking noise that he had heard his parents making sometimes when they felt a special fondness for each other. He eventually gets a reply, and he befriends a young Manxy. Over the next few days, he visits the young Manxy many times and learns a little of the language. The young Manxy already knows from his own parents what a journey is in front of him, and tells Piran all about the land very far away, thousands of miles away, over on the other side of the great ocean. And that's where he will spend the winter. Piran is inspired. "How far west can I go?"
he wonders. The start of the long journey. One sunny evening, Kitto and Quick reveal their secret plan to Piran. The couple often meet up, as they did on Llandwyn, on the beach, feeding on insects with the other chuffs, before roosting on the cliffs on the east side of the island. They are on a mission also. Not a mission born out of a sense of adventure and honest curiosity like Piran's, but one with a more noble purpose. They want to return to their old, traditional, long-lost homeland and resettle. Their thinking is shared by many of the young chuffs around, it seems. The place is called Cernyw. Kitto and Quick have heard a rumour that other chuffs are also moving south to try and regain their old haunts on the cliffs of West Penwith in the far, far south. Piran decides he likes this plan.
"Go south, young man," he quietly declares to himself.
"Piran, the aimless wanderer," he chuckles. Whatever their different motives for the journey, Piran reasons that three minds are better than one. The friends decide to team up for the long journey south. Safety in numbers. The journey starts east towards the rising sun along the south coast of the Llyn Peninsula, passing two grand castles and crossing three wide estuaries after the coast turns south. The birds fly hard and purposefully, using any uplift from the sea breezes and staying just inland of the coastline.
Youngster, flex thy panoply and ride with the westerly by the banded giant Cilan Uchaf, and seek the great sands that roll and whip as sleeping waves.
As the coast turns south, there are deep valleys of ancient oak woodland sheltering in the low hills. The long, deep estuaries hereabouts are particularly beautiful. It's rare to see undisturbed land and forest again after all the farmland, Perrin thinks to himself. He's reminded of the remnant pieces of oak woodland around Dinorwig, the place that he has left behind. Those are all that's left now, where once there were great forests covering the land.
Ride in the upwind that buffets the hill, sunwards to the strip ribbon Avon Mauvac, and on to the idle painted shores of Aberduffy.
Beyond, by Ceredigion, extends to the south for a full 100 miles toward the next major landmark, Tŷ Dewi, a large cathedral set in a wooded hollow near the coast. It is mentioned in the songline. Just a little further is a large island where the three birds can relax and rest. The journey from Enlli has taken them 3 days so far.
Spread thy fingered wings o'er the wave-beat, sun-beat shore. Follow till it is no more. Here Innis Dewi surfaces for breath. Take sanctuary upon its back. To outstrip day is death.
The coast here is very spectacular, and Kitto and Quick stop often to play in the wind with a few other chuffs that they are surprised to find on the cliffs. Piran is also surprised to see so many ravens here. The travellers glean as much information as they can from the resident birds about the next section of the journey. The next 100 miles is not easy country to traverse. They are apprehensive about this next sector. But the three are committed to their mission and continue without playing as much as they would have liked. Soon, as they continue east once more, the coast becomes more open and flat, and even though they pass some spectacular estuaries and very large strands of sand, there are more and more humans about. They concentrate hard on the flying, trying to keep a line as straight as possible, avoiding the human danger zones. All three feel a little out of their depth. They are all working a bit too hard. This feels like a point of no return. On the second day, the southern wind swings to the west. Ideal! What luck! The wind is behind them now, allowing a gentle drift to the east. The weather is fresh. Low pressure, rising air, perfect for cross-country flying, with small, individual, fluffy white clouds popping out at 3,000 feet, a good height, so they can now see where the thermals are. This allows Piran to use the technique he learnt from the gulls on Urwidva. Now he has to show Kitto and Quick how it's done, and quickly. He shouts over, "The clouds mark the top of each thermal!" He chooses a good thermal to start the manoeuvre, not too strong, and takes it all the way to cloud base, taking the protesting chuffs with him in tight circles, higher than they have ever been. Kitto and Quick handle this remarkably well. Their primary feathers read the air currents like a gull, real fine tuners. They are so high that the humans and their associated noises are gone. They can now see very far towards the horizon, with green hills forever to their left, a brown sea to the right, and a very faint line of blue-grey hills in the distance and beyond the sea. That's where they want to go. At the top of each thermal, as the lift dissipates, and just before he goes into the cloud, Piran shouts to Kitto and Quick, "Are your mouths dry yet?" But before they can call back, Piran shouts, "Follow me, now! Stay in the same air! Stay close!" He heads downwind in a glide to the east, altering the direction slightly towards the way they want to go. When they start getting low again and can hear the noise of humans, they find the next cloud and drift underneath it to find rising air again.
Be idle in the westerly, till Aberhavren's dwindle sea is beached. Now to the sun, and glide till the break, 'twixt land and land is breached.
The day's travel continues very efficiently, with hardly any flapping needed, and each glide making about 20 to 30 miles for them. Kitto and Quick are delighted with this method of flying. It's so different to their usual acrobatic low-level behaviour on the sea cliffs.
"So efficient," Kitto says. "If the weather stays the same, we'll do 100 miles today like this."
"Quick, let's go again. Follow Piran," says Quick.
Luckily, the weather stayed fine, and by the time they could make out land, now much closer on their right, the coast swung north towards a huge human bridge. Not what they wanted to see, because now it was time to cross the water. One last lift to cloud base, and they committed to the crossing where they thought they had a sufficient safety margin, going across the wind this time. They made the crossing to a place called Somerset.
Reaching Somerset. Roosting as safely as they could every night, the three friends continued their journey west, again trying to keep to the coast, even though there were many humans. At least the navigation was easy, as Kitto and Quick kept chattering.
"Keep the land on your left," said Kitto constantly.
"Green to the left, grey to the right," quipped Quick in quick response.
They find that the land they fly over now is a vast, green, human desert. Inland, all the food is wrapped up by humans. Insects are scarce for the chuffs. They have to land on the coast in seaweed to feed on insects.
They prefer short, cropped grassland, not tall crops and lush pasture. The land is barren for many birds except for the very best scavengers, like the gulls and common crows. There are no dead animals left out to be scavenged by the ravens. The land is clean and tidy, large fields and no hedgerows, just fences. And the humans are very protective of their animals. Many birds are shot here for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Pirin and the Chuffs continue steadily along this coastal corridor, mostly hugging the coast and stopping early each afternoon to find a good roost for Pirin and a cave or crevice for the Chuffs to roost in. Fulmars, the tube noses, are becoming a big problem for other seabirds on this coast, stealing nesting territory from all others. They have spread south over recent years. When in an argument, a fulmar can project vomit at its attacker, and when any seabird is covered with fulmar oil, this will mean certain death for that bird. The victim cannot clean the oil off, the feathers become useless, and the bird cannot fly. Fulmars, therefore, always win arguments, and are invading everyone's territory all along the coast. A wise raven will never challenge a fulmar, not even a fulmar chick. Pirin and his two friends fly south for many days, being careful not to roost near the fulmars, who seem to be everywhere on the cliff ledges. The flying is enjoyable, with 300-foot cliffs all along the coast, and Pirin wonders when the land will run out, as it did on the Hlin. After 2 days of hard flying, the coast turns a corner to the south, and the coastal scenery becomes even more spectacular. This is the calm coast, with its craggy cliffs sticking out to the sea at right angles, spectacularly so in places. The Chuffs love these cliffs for flying. Kitto and Quick are in their element, playing and tumbling at every opportunity in the wind. Soon they meet other ravens, who tell them that ahead lies Tintagel, which will be difficult to pass, maybe, for Tintagel is a special place. Like Clogwyndir Ar Ddu on Yrwyddfa and Carrig y Llam on the Hlin, Tintagel is a key territory. No one knows why, because its history has vanished in the mists of time, but it is said that humans had many battles here, and even before the humans appeared after the Great Cold, ravens have always held territories here and have special reverence for this place. Along this coast, all that is left of the old, truly wild land is the rim of the now human-dominated land between the green fields and the sea cliffs themselves. A very narrow but continuous strip of wilderness. This is where the ravens like to be, where there are no humans, where it is safe to nest, where they can make forays inland to find food. They are totally dependent on this fragile strip of land for their existence. It is a hard life here for a raven. That's why it's guarded so well. It is precious. Other birds value this strip of coast too, and for the same reasons. Pirin, Kitto and Quick meet the elders of Tintagel, who admire their bravery to fly so far without mishap. They all complain about the fulmars. They tell Kitto and Quick they are not alone in wanting to resettle in West Penwith. Many more Chuffs are doing the same these days, they confirm. The elders have seen some of them pass through. The pair are very excited with this news. In fact, they are so excited with the news that they say goodbye to Pirin quickly and fly off along the coast, chattering. Pirin is sorry to see them go and wonders what will become of them. Pirin, now alone, continues slowly along the coast. He sees the sea on the other side of the peninsula, just like he did on the Hlin, and he wonders how much land is left before it all ends. Land's End. After a further 2 days of easy flying, Piran finally reaches the Land's End and finds a perch on the cliffs of Senan Cove, wondering about his next move. It's an anti-climax for him. The sea is much noisier here. The swell and the waves are much bigger than any he's seen on the whole journey. He has an ice cream and looks out at a lighthouse and watches a lonely gannet dive for his supper.
How do they do that? Piran wonders. What skill?
He recalls that it was a conversation with a Manxi chick on Entley that inspired this adventure at the beginning, after he had seen Manxis for the first time. Had he not had that conversation, he might have not had this big adventure. Oh well, said Piran. Nothing ventured, nothing won. Piran decided to go out to the lighthouse to hang around and attempt to meet and talk with the gannet. Early next morning, Piran is perched on the helicopter pad on top of the longship's lighthouse, looking for a passing gannet to greet. The weather is rough with a big southerly swell rolling in, but he fails to make contact with a gannet. The big birds are too busy diving for fish in the rough seas. Piran can keep up with the gannets quite easily, but they are simply not chatty. They ignore him. Piran is surprised how large they are. He returns to Senan Cove. He wants more adventure. From his favourite perch on the cliffs of Senan, he notices that on some evenings some Manxis fly quite close to the land. On one night he flies out and makes contact with one of them and asks how far the next land is. He is now supremely fit and can almost catch up with a Manxi in a short burst.
There are the Isles of Scilly, 25 miles out. Then that's it for a land bird like you. The next land is 2,000 miles further.
Piran says he thinks he could fly across to the Scillies.
You might do if I show you how, said the Manxi.
This young Manxi was quite impressed with the confidence of the shiny big black bird and made the offer honestly. She was quite interested to see what this raven can do. The friendly petrel gives a demonstration and flies along the front face of a wave, almost shearing the water with her wingtip. Perfection. Piran has a hard time keeping up. Watching from about 50 feet, the Manxi is so fast. He sees what to do, but he just can't bring himself to do it, to fly so close to the water. She tells him it's easy to fly very close to the waves, and that's the secret of long flights across the sea, using the power of the waves. Piran is not sure about this, but says nothing, and he's too scared to try it. It's totally against Raven's sensibilities to fly close to the waves. But even so, Manxi is enjoying Piran's enthusiasm. She wants to help and offers to guide him across to the Scillies tomorrow. Piran turns up, as they had arranged, by the lighthouse. The wind is from the west, which is against them. But it is only a light wind, and Piran thinks nothing of it. He feels confident with his fitness, and with his expert guide, he sets off. Manxi shouts instructions, but Piran is too scared and he doesn't listen properly. He's flying using pure energy, flapping his wings, not gliding the front of the waves as he's been told. The prevailing westerly headwind suddenly increases in force, slowing him down considerably, more than halving his ground speed.
I can't keep this up for long, he says to himself.
Piran has seriously overestimated his fitness for going such a distance against the wind. By halfway, 10 miles, he is exhausted. Flying against a strong wind, he is barely making headway. In a panic, he flies up 100 feet or so to further his horizon, wasting energy and losing contact with Manxi as he does so.
"Should I turn back?" he asks himself.
Manxis do not fly high. Why should they? Their way of life keeps them at sea level. That's where they feed, so the lower they are, the more likely they are to see their food. Piran scours the horizon for any sign of land, but rain showers and clouds obscure his view. He loses sight of the mainland somewhere behind him. He feels panic now, and all the red lights are flashing in his head. He needs to remain calm. He hears the dull drone of the motor of a boat coming from somewhere far away. He can't see it. Ravens have acute hearing, and sounds carry well over water. Suddenly he sees a fishing boat far ahead. It's his only hope. He aims straight for it, gets above it, circles, and manages to land, ungainly in a heap on deck, right at the scuttling feet of a surprised fisherman. All ravens believe that they are born with two containers in their soul. One is called the experience jar, which is empty at birth. The other, the luck jar, is full to the brim at birth. As they go through life, every time the bird finds itself in extremis, for any reason, and gets away with it and survives, he or she loses a pebble from the luck jar, which goes into the experience jar. And so one day, as every raven knows, even though the experience jar is full, the luck jar will run out. Piran is an experienced youngster, and that was another stroke of luck, and another pebble out of the luck jar. He's only just over a year old, but he has found himself in extremis many times. He now needs more luck, and for this very first human contact to be a good one. The fisherman comes out of his cabin, stares at him, steadying himself on the rigging as the boat is reeling and rocking in the wild sea. Piran is sliding about with his claws, trying to grip on anything on the hard wooden deck, and trying to look dignified at the same time. The fisherman keeps looking, as if deciding what to do, and says nothing. Then he turns, walks away back into the cabin. Piran realizes he is completely at the mercy of this man. But immediately the fisherman comes back with a crust of pasty. Piran devours it. It's a lifesaver. Piran, too tired to think straight, perches himself with a tight grip to the nets at the back of the fishing boat, just feeling so glad to be alive. As he ponders his luck, meeting this human in this place, he notices many Manxis flying past. Then one of them shouts to him, "Stay on board! I think the boat is running for shelter before the storm. It's going to the Scillies." Manxi has found him again. The Manxi with the magic radar. "How do they do that?" Piran wonders. It is late afternoon as Piran, now recovered, sails into the harbour at St. Mary's on the Scilly Isles, noticed by no one except some cackling gulls. He has reached the low-lying, sandy and rocky isles of Scilly. This is a beautiful spot, but no place for a raven. The highest point of the whole set of small islands is only a few feet above sea level. His judgment and confidence is shaken. It has nearly been a misadventure. Before leaving the boat, the man comes over to him and says something softly, and Piran croaks back softly. After resting for a few days and scavenging from the humans on the island to survive, he decides it's time to attempt to return to the mainland. Piran wants to go home to the Norweg.
Remember, black fledgling, thou'rt a raven. Thy purse blackness fashioned in endless travail by ravens afore thee. Most needy of peers, a score beyond your span. Seek not reverence, know thy gifts, thy fragile season, and match thy fantasy with reason.
With the prevailing wind to his back on the return trip, he can double his ground speed with half the effort. It shouldn't take long. After all, Piran reasons, he's now a vastly more experienced seabird, and the wind is always from the west in West Penwith. What could possibly go wrong? He has to start back from a lower altitude due to the weak thermals being blown apart over the Scillies by the prevailing southwesterlies. Piran decides to make a start one fine, clear morning on the westerly breeze. He's hoping that Manxie has her radar working and so will somehow magically find him out at sea. After 10 miles, the westerly wind unexpectedly changes direction and turns against him. It turns easterly. This rarely happens. His luck jar may be empty. This is very bad luck. "Do as I do or die," says Manxie, coming from nowhere, skimming closely past beneath him. "Get low and in front of the waves." But Piran has lost his confidence and his thinking is blurred. All he can do is flap as hard as he can. It's too late to turn back. He's too tired, and he's too tired to fly high to look for a boat. There is still a big residual swell running from the west, steepened by the easterly wind. He can only beat his wings as hard as he can against the wind, but he drops lower and lower and is running out of energy. He knows the sinking feeling from the outrun, but there is no fishing boat this time. Finally, with certain death a few feet away, he falls beneath the front of a big wave. And suddenly he sees lots of little birds, almost as if walking on the water. They are black, with a white rump. They are hovering. They have tiny webbed feet dangling on the water. He suddenly hears himself shout, "Wow, look at that!" And he is shaken out of his trance he is in by the sound of his own voice. Piran sees hundreds of tiny creatures swimming near the surface of the water, and the small tube noses are feeding on the creatures. He sees them clearly, something one would notice only when inches away from the wild frothy water and certain death. He cannot understand why he can see so clearly, why he is noticing these things in the water when he is inches away from certain death. He cannot understand his reactions. This is the last wave he is ever going to see. This is the end. And he's thinking about tiny little creatures that he is about to join in the water. But then he suddenly feels a gentle lift. There is rising air on the front face of the wave, being pushed up by the wave as it travels forward. Now he has a few moments to think clearly. "So this is what Manxie was trying to tell me." He relaxes a little and steadies himself. He controls his breathing. Manxie, who has been watching all the time, breathes a little easier also. Slow and deep. It is now very clear what Piran has to do. He stops beating his wings and soars with stiff straight wings on the front steep wall of the wave. This takes a lot less energy. He trims his wings as best he can, as he has practiced so many times. Now he really needs all these newfound skills. Stretch and tuck like a gull. Get the pitch right. Even more like a Manxie. But he still has a long way to go to reach safety. At least 10 miles, Manxie reckons. Although being deep in the troughs of the waves, they cannot see land, only the back of the wave in front. Piran has to have all his wits about him to surf this wave of rising air that but is only as high as the wave itself. He also has to navigate to reach the narrow peninsula of Cornwall. He tries to follow Manxy as she soars up and into the wind. She gets enough speed and power from the front of the wave so that she can soar up and above the wave and make headway into the wind. But Piran can't do that. Sometimes he soars a little too high, just to be able to see the coast in the distance. The swell is 30 feet high, but Piran cannot go too low into the trough where the lift is very weak, or too high where the wind rotors off the top of the wave. Piran concentrates very hard and uses every bit of flying ability he has learned in his short life. Sometimes he is too high and too far back over the crest and is buffeted badly over the top of the wave, through the rotor and into the next trough. He knows how to handle rotors from his mountain days, but it takes energy to maintain control when this happens, and to get back in control on the front of the next wave. At least there is always a next wave, he thinks to himself. After an hour of intense concentration, Piran realizes that, despite being in such deep trouble, he's actually having the time of his life. He has never felt so good. His body and mind are tingling with the excitement of his predicament. He is in control, just. He finally sees the cliffs of Chair Ladder, with a huge crashing swell spraying white water right up over the top of the cliff. He saves his last ergs of energy for this final airlift over the cliff, and crash lands in gorse bushes in a field full of beautiful sheep. Covered in thorns and absolutely shattered, Piran has a huge smile on his face. He has never had such a good time, ever. He sits there, deep in the gorse, quietly letting the rain drip down to wash the salt from his encrusted feathers. He picks a few moths and falls into a deep sleep.
Follow thy course, twixt the land and the sea. Follow the spirit unseen and unheard, of the very first voyage, of the very first bird. Mark thy success, for the bird is in thee.
New beginnings. 3 months later, on a dark and stormy late November day, Piran returns to the shores of Llanduin.
Know it, bird. This passage hath no end. Despite thy measured gains afore, thou'll answer to a natural law. Every west doth have a west, but there is something more.
Piran skirts the bleached sand in an arc to land on a small promontory of pillow lava that gives him an unbroken view of the beach, the forest, the distant mountains, and his birthplace. And, of course, the aspiring acrobats. A steady wind blows in from the direction of the setting sun. It skims the pale green sea, drawing with it fine droplets of salty moisture, before accelerating across the sand and shooting skywards in an invisible plume as it hits the bank of dunes flanking the beach. As Piran knows, on late afternoons like this, conditions are perfect at the far seaward reaches of the roost for practicing aerial skills to show off to each other, and 50 or more young ravens are playing there on the turbulent updrafts. It is Erona that has caught Piran's gaze. Erona is absorbed in a new trick.
Piran is here, again. He knows not that his new-found strength be my weakness. 'Tis nature to blame. Piran is here again. A picture in my slender frame.
Author's Notes.
My name is Alan Hughes and I'm the author of this book. I live at Fachwen, above and across the lake from the village of Llanberis, North Wales. This is Raven Country, and over many years of observation whilst mountain walking in Eryri, I have developed an affinity for the raven. Nearly every time I go outside at home, I hear and see a pair of ravens flying above me, watching. In my mind, there has always been something very reliable, relaxed, and even regal about the raven. I don't understand the murderous reputation they have and the persecution they have suffered at the hands of humans over the years. In 2010, I decided to build a hide to observe and photograph a nesting pair of ravens less than a mile away from my home. It was a solid structure made of a frame of branches and an old green tent that resulted in a set of still photographs that have been used for this project. I still remember having cold hands while lashing the hide together in late December with bits of nylon string. It had to be finished before the new year, because I knew the ravens would start building their nest in early January and could not be disturbed after that time. Over the following 5 months, the hours spent alone in the hide allowed me to enter the raven world, a rare and very special experience, and to side with the raven. It fired my imagination. This children's book idea originated from the notes and photos taken 10 years ago, but came together as a lockdown project during the spring of 2021. I invited George into the project to bring an extra dimension into the work, to build in a contrast of style. We had worked together before on a film project called Upside Down Wales, and I was well aware of his creative wordsmithing talent. He also lives on Bachwen. Libby was involved initially back in 2010 when we collaborated in a Nature in Wales project. She had written a short story to go with some of my shots, and that piece has now become a stimulus and the first chapter of this longer story. She lives very close to the raven territory in the story and hears them nearly every day. Cadfan and Morwenna, we believe, are still here and still producing young ones every year. So this project is a coming together of various loose ends in an attempt to produce something of lasting interest to young and old alike.
Credits. The first chapter, The Beginning, was written by Libby Peter. Sound recording was by myself, Steve Delight. Music was also by myself. The Raven audiobook was published by Keith Robertson. Raven copyright by Alan Hughes. This was a Vakwen Collective production, January 2022.